the new, but it's very old. Schaffer's Encyclopedia of Religious Knowledge. If you're looking for apostolic, you can go to volume one. Akin to Basilians. And then you turn pages like I did, hoping you'll find it. Very interesting encyclopedia. Apostolic Constitutions and Canons. We referred to that last night, didn't we? Huh?
Yes, sir.
Are you all here? Apostolic Constitutions and Canons is the name applied to an ancient collection of ecclesiastical precepts. The Constitutions profess to be regulations for the organization of the Church, put forth by the apostles themselves, and published to the faithful by Clement of Rome. They consist of 8 books. They were unknown in the West until the 16th century. Anglican theologians then took a great interest in them and frequently upheld their apostolic origin. The 85 canons have the form of synodal decisions and proceeded from a Syrian source, not much later than the Constitutions. They were generally received, the canons, as genuine, included in many collections of church law, and translated into several Oriental languages. To this day, they stand at the beginning of the canonical system of the Eastern Orthodox Church, as they publish the canonical system, which is an accumulation of the decisions of church synods. These 85 canons stand at the beginning of that system of the Eastern Church, or in the canonical system as the Eastern Church would publish it. The first 50 of these 85 canons were made known to the West by Dionysius Exiguus, from whom they passed into a number of Latin collections. For example, the Pseudo-Isidorian Decretals, the Decretum Gratiani, and the Decretals of Gregory the Ninth. The unique value of the Constitutions lies in the fact that they give a picture down to the minutest details of the life of a Christian community of the third century, the daily life of the individual and the family, the public worship, the wide practical charity, strict moral discipline, the relation of the church to the state and to the surrounding world. You know, there's just a lot the tradition is passing on now is left out. I'll bet you there are just a lot of people listening to me never heard of the Apostolic Constitutions or the canons. Now, the fact that they've been subject to criticism says no more than the fact that the entire New Testament's been subject to criticism. Now, I'm not suggesting that they should be included in Scripture. We are simply looking at New Testament history as a historian. We have followed the tracings of the church at Jerusalem and seen the dominance of the family of Christ, family members dominating the bishopric of the city. And not until the Romans barred the Jews from the city of Jerusalem did a Gentile bishop pastor the church at Jerusalem. We have seen the dominance of the philosophic thermopeutai as defined by Philo in the roots of the church at Alexandria. We began to touch a little on the church at Antioch. We have not really traced the version of the church at Rome as Eusebius gives us, which is a loaded version designed to serve the purpose of the church that had moved in its center to the east as it became the official church in the days of Eusebius, the so-called father of church history, and the identity of the church with the Roman state structure that had moved its capital under Constantine to Constantinople, and the suppression of the true history of the Church of the West. Why is it that we think that these early church fathers were so holy they were incapable of carnal motives? If you would just suddenly transfer Jerry Falwell and his squabbles, Jim Baker, there's a juicy little bit of news on Jessica that came out today. I mean, some madam is now sharing the spotlight who says she worked for her as a prostitute in the 1970s. I mean, if I were a madam, I'd be dadgummed if I'd let some broad rehabilitate herself as the national virgin either. I mean, move over, Jessica, and give me some of that loot. I mean, wouldn't it bother you if you were madam? I mean, here she was working hard for her money, sharing her little percentage of the pennies that Jessica earned, and then all of a sudden Jessica plays a role as a defiled virgin and gets all those millions from Playboy, and the madam doesn't get a cut of it, I'd holler too. Anyway, the early church was populated by a people, flesh and blood, Jerry Falwell types and Jim Baker types, and Church of the Open Door types also. Then there was a Gene Scott type or two, like Paul, that just caused trouble all the time and made the establishment angry. Very few people take serious Paul's statement, "All they which are in Asia have turned against me." And I keep telling you, as we move up to 144 AD, we never got that far in our study of church history, except in oblique references, before the Jim Baker debacle and what I called the religious mafioso battling over the Carolina Territory, Jerry the Fat, his consigliori gutman, Jimmy the Wimp, and his painted up Holy Moll. We're fighting it out. We then jumped up to the fights of the first seven church ecumenical councils, just to sort of keep the sanity of the Christian church, that the church would survive this one too, considering what it survived in those first few centuries. And we are slowly seeing the ability of the church to survive this one too. But we skipped over 144 AD. And the rescue of Paul for the church by a heretic, no less. And this truth of the church in Britain and the church in the south of France was suppressed. And we're rescuing it. All right? That enough review? And a lot of the stuff that we have been reading in these two books, the drama of the lost disciples and the coming of the saints by J.W. Taylor, and that little boat now begins to make some sense on the cover, comes from sources like the Apostolic Constitutions and many other documents that have fallen into disuse, particularly in the Western Protestant Church. Now, we were on pilgrimage in the south of France, from Marseille to Saint Maximin, and now, having traveled to the little grotto where Mary Magdalene was to have been buried and her relics allegedly were kept, I was reading at this point, St. Louis came, as we are told, by the sire of de Joinville to St. Maximin, a little distance from Aix, where St. Mary Magdalene was interred, where there's a deep cave in a rock in which it is said the Holy Magdalene lived for a long time. Countless pilgrims have done the same before and since, and what William the son of Otho is said to have done in 935, and what Louis de Joinville did in 1254, one naturally does today if staying at St. Maximin. The place, Le Saint Bon, as it is now called, is about 18 kilometers from St. Maximin. We go back through the place, the plaza, towards the station, then turn sharply to the right. And almost immediately, the rugged mountain range, which is our goal, presents itself directly in front of us. About 2 kilometers out, we pass, on the left, an old stone pillar or cross called St. Pilon, which is said to mark the place to which St. Mary Magdalene was brought when dying in order to receive a last communion from the hands of St. Maximin. Beyond this, the road passes through some miles of vineyards and olive trees, the vines with large bunches of purple grapes showing under the lower branches or resting on the ground. The olive trees are, of course, recognized at once by the peculiar grayish or dusky color of their foliage. These two covered with olives. Further on, we pass through a kind of avenue of mulberry trees. One or two large almond trees. Don't say almond to me either. I come from Northern California. We know you beat the hell out of almonds. One or two large almond trees and fruit are particularly beautiful. About 10 kilometers out, we come to the village of Nans, a large village, considering its isolation, with a place or a plaza also, trees, fountain, surmounted by an image of St. Mary in a narrow street. Shortly after leaving the road, or shortly after leaving this, the road begins to ascend, and for 6 or 7 kilometers, there's a continuous uphill winding way. As we gradually come nearer to the foot of the mountain, we see clearly outlined against the darker color of the rock wall, and you don't care. I've been over this, but I would guess that those of you that for whom this consists of a little bit of review are picking up some additional things as we've woven them in. This is why we wanted to take our own pilgrimage or teaching tour to the south of France to help rediscover this ancient history. And as I said last night and the earlier nights, I don't really care whether the relics are genuine or not. The important point is only here do you find the claim of the relics existing. Because these close to Christ arrived in this area within 3 to 5 years after the death and resurrection of Christ. And it was in the south of France and in the Silurian kingdom of Britain and in and around Glastonbury and Avalon that the first missionaries out of Palestine came. Why have we not been told this? How many of you have heard of the Magdeburg centuries? Put a camera on them. I would turn the lights on. I said put a camera on them, and so leave the lights on them. That's a crooked camera. How many of you have heard of the Magdeburg centuries? The Magdeburg centuries. One. How many of you know what they are? I'm going to ask you on public TV. Let me know what they are. One. What are they? Well, that's not quite right. It sounds, that's a nice logical deduction. If I were to tell you that the Magdeburg centuries is the name of a volume of church history, how many of you now know that to be the case? I don't think anybody. And I don't mean to embarrass anybody. My guess was, if there were 1,000 people in here, there would be nobody hold their hand up. And it's a very logical deduction to assume what was assumed. Because you don't normally go right off . It's not a normal title for a book, the Magdeburg centuries, or a set of books. They represent the first attempt to write the history of the church from the evangelical point of view after the Reformation. Now, it takes time to do this. And if you that are home held up your hand, you would probably guess the same thing. Now, don't you think if this is if the evangelical churches are the fruit of the Protestant Reformation, that the very first attempt to write the history of the church after some 15 to 16 centuries of total dominance by the medieval church that brought forth the Lutheran Reformation to restore the role of faith in the saving process, that the first attempt to write the history of the church from that viewpoint deserves a little bit of emphasis. I mean, how would you like to study the history of the American Revolution written only by the British of the 1700s? I mean, you ought to read some of the speeches to the House of Parliament. During the days that these upstart rebels in the colonies dared to challenge the authority of the king and of Britain. They're not extremely laudatory towards such individuals as the father of our country, George Washington. Parliament did not view him the same way the little boys and girls are made to view him in the schools of America. That makes sense? And if you want to let little boys and girls studying American history in this country to be able to lift up their head with a little sense of dignity, you don't want American history to be taught as reflected in the speeches of Parliament during the days of the American Revolution. We tend to teach American history and tell our side of the story. It's the right side. I mean, those pompous red coats were very fair, the way they marched down the streets and across the bridges. They fought the way gentlemen are supposed to fight. And these American revolutionaries hiding in the bushes like a bunch of Indians, shooting them in the back and in the behind. You don't fight wars like that. They didn't even dress up for war. These uncouth American revolutionaries. They didn't even know how to dress for battle. They just won it. Now the point is, don't you think that the very first attempt to write the history of the church from the evangelical point of view deserves a little bit of attention by those that grow up in the evangelical church and go to Sunday school for 40 years? That's why I agree. Sunday school is the most wasted hour in a week in most churches. And here, one of the best taught churches in America doesn't know what the Magdeburg centuries are. I'll bet you anything, you can graduate from Jimmy Swaggart's Bible College and never hear of the Magdeburg centuries. And I'll double the bet that you can graduate from what was that? From Lynchburg, Liberty Baptist College, and you will never hear the Magdeburg centuries. The plan of this work was conceived by Matthias Flacius. He projected a church history from the original sources, showing that the Church of Christ, since the time of the apostles, had deviated from the right course. Let's read that again. He projected a church history from the original sources, showing that the Church of Christ since the time of the apostles had deviated from the right course, a documentary history of anti-Christianity in the Church of Christ from its beginnings to its highest development up to the restoration of true religion in its purity by Luther. That was the objective of the Magdeburg centuries. Well, I like its idea going out the gate. Y'all can sit down, you know. Well, maybe not. You want me to continue?
Yes, sir.
I mean, you know, next time Jehovah's Witness shows up, you say, the Magdeburg centuries prove you're all wet. And they don't know what the Magdeburg centuries are. Take your kid games elsewhere. You're not even graduated yet. Now, my guess is if I could talk to all of those that joined us this half hour, and I were to ask the question, what are the Magdeburg centuries? Chances are not one person listening, and certainly very few listening, could answer the question. The first attempt to write the history of the church from the evangelical point of view is what the Magdeburg centuries were. The plan of this work was conceived by Matthias Flacius. He projected a church history from the original sources, showing that the Church of Christ since the time of the apostles had deviated from the right course. A documentary history of anti-Christianity in the Church of Christ from its beginnings to its highest development up to the restoration of true religion and its purity by Luther. That's a worthwhile endeavor. And to show you how little effect this has had on church history and how little known it is to at least the American church, the bibliography on this consists of F.C. Bauer, the Epiken der Kirchlichen, and my German is going to leave about as much to be desired as my French. Geschichtsschreibung, die Epiken der Kirchlichen Geschichtsschreibung. Utrecht's the Historiography der Geschichten. Not much better than the other time. Agent les Centuries de Magdeburg. Schamkel. Vitrag Zur. And you German people out there, don't try to teach me how to say it. I'm just a hopeless case. Betrugzer Inchung Geschicht der Magd Centurion. That's about all I'm going to make you struggle through, and not a single source in English. That's the point. And while the German people agonize through that, I've told you this before, when I was studying French, and on the doctorate, you didn't need to speak it, all you had to do was read it. And I could never handle the French. My French professor used to come up and say, "You're so typically American, Mr. Scott, I want you to recite. When you get done, we have a lesson for the day." I did all the wrong things. The point I'm making is there's not a single source in this bibliography in English. The sole sources, if I'd continue to read them, German and French. Which, by the way, is one of the reasons why that your ancient universities or your established universities in America and the PhD program still require two foreign languages for that research degree. And they don't really care if you speak it, as long as you can read it. I still remember my French exam for the PhD at Stanford. I walked in cold turkey. The chairman of the French department handed me Being and Not Being by Jean-Paul Sartre. That's hard to understand in English, much less in French. And she opened it to a random spot and says, start translating. And I could read it, but if she'd asked me to recite it, I'd still be at Stanford. Translate it, yeah. But the research degrees require you to go to the sources, and so often the translations into English are not available. But for this, the first attempt to write the history of the church from the evangelical point of view, to have no circulation, so to speak, and relatively, in the English language, shows you how right the Eastern Orthodox Church is in considering Protestantism to have just become another branch of the Catholic Church. He, Matthias Flacius, or Flacius, projected a church history from the original sources showing that the Church of Christ since the time of the Apostles had deviated from the right course. A documentary history of anti-Christianity and the Church of Christ from its beginnings to its highest development up to the restoration of true religion and its purity by Luther. You see, I'm not doing anything too heretical. I mean, the ecumenical movement has so homogenized things that there's little critical study of the way the church got off the track within one century after the New Testament. You know what happened to the cannibal who ate a Baptist? From 1553, Flacius gave his efforts to the securing of patrons to aid the work financially. No matter how worthy the Christian cause, it takes some money. From 1553, Flacius gave his efforts to the securing of patrons to aid the work financially, whom he found among German noblemen and wealthy citizens in Augsburg, Nuremberg, and elsewhere, and in obtaining collaborators. The active interest and assistance manifested by the imperial counselor Niedbruck, curator of the Royal Library in Vienna, proved especially valuable. Libraries had to be searched for sources and documents. And for this purpose, Flacius himself undertook journeys into Germany, and his assistant Marcus Wagner of Freimar near Gotha, with great success, traveled through Denmark, Scotland, Austria, Bavaria, and other territories, while many manuscripts and books were purchased or donated by patrons. Sounds like they worked as hard to get their product as Jerry Falwell and Jimmy Swaggart do on their messages. You're here. In Magdeburg, Flacius, Johann Wiegand, and Matthias Judex stood at the head of the project and worked out the details of the plan. The counselor Ebeling Alleman and the physician Martin Kopus were treasurers. Assistants were trained in furnishing the necessary excerpts, which two learned masters put into shape. This is no picayune job. From Jena, Flacius directed the entire work. Thus there appeared in Basil, 1559 to 74, the Ecclesiastica Historia Secundum Singula Centurius, per Alico Studiosus e Pius Veros in Urba Magdeburgica. Hence the name, that was the long name, the shortened name, the Magdeburg Centuries. Centuries 7 to 13 were elaborated especially by Wiegand and Wismar. And I should say Wiegand and Wismar. Sometimes when I go from English to German and their W's become V's, I mean, why can't Wittenberg be Wittenberg instead of Wittenberg? Like the Italian studying English says, if it be he to be to him, and then why can't a she be to shim? Centuries 7 to 13 were elaborated especially by Wiegand in Wismar. Wiegand and subsequently Stengewald afterward worked on the three following centuries without completing them. The 16th century, compiled by Wiegand, is in Wolfenbüttel in manuscript form. If I work at it, one word at a time, I can struggle through. Attempts made by several persons in the 18th century to bring the work down to date were also without result. The centuries mark immense progress in ecclesiastical historiography, not only by the tracing of the sources and the completeness with which the material was collected. I mean, this was a coordinated effort in a smaller scale, analogous to the assembling of scholars to do the King James Version by King James. The centuries, I repeat, mark immense progress in ecclesiastical historiography, not only by the tracing of the sources and the completeness with which the material was collected, but also because there is applied in them the pragmatic method of historical development. The anti-Roman interest sharpened the vision and helped the authors of the work to critical achievements that marked a new epoch. The Roman Church called it pestilentissimum opus. It was a pestilence from their view, because that's the cognate for our word pestilence. And it was called that by the Roman opponents, but it made a very strong impression upon the Roman Church. Thus, the Roman Church urged the most learned theologians in their midst to attack it, and many pens were set in motion until in Caesar Baronius there was found an able opponent who drew his material from the Roman sources themselves. Now, you notice in the list of the places that the writers, under the direction of the one coordinator, in the list of sources, as they traveled through many countries and many libraries, were eloquently absent in naming the Vatican as a source. Now, when Luther and Calvin and Knox lit the fire of the Reformation, the Catholic Church would have been doomed, all historians agree, except for the Counter-Reformation led by Loyola and the Jesuits. And the Council of Trent was a retrenchment of the Catholic Church against, as they view it, the falling away of the Protestant Reformation. Likewise, the power and effect of these Magdeburg centuries in exposing what they claimed was the anti-Christian deviation from the apostolic foundations of the church, caused a reaction and had such an impact on the Roman Catholics that they sought to attack it, and they found the counterbalance in one Caesar Baronius. And he thus, as the Council of Trent, represents the still standing position of reaffirmation of the Catholic Church. Baronius is viewed as the father of church history among Roman Catholics since the Reformation. As the Magdeburg Centuries represents the first evangelical attempt to correct the history of the church after the Reformation, Caesar Baronius is considered the father of church history among Roman Catholics since the Reformation. Born at Sora, not far from Rome, in the kingdom of Naples, October 31st, 1538, his family was ancient and distinguished for piety. He was educated first at Veroli, then at Naples, where he studied theology and law. He went to Rome in 1557, just at the time when Pope Paul IV was attempting to restore the papacy to its medieval splendor and dominion. But he felt less attraction to public policy than to a life of scholarly retirement. This he found in the new congregation of the Oratory under Philip Neri, whose system prepared the young man without his knowledge for the great work he was to do. This congregation of the Oratory, or the Oratorians as they were called, were directed by their founder to occupy the morning hours with studies in ecclesiastical matters, but in a manner which should conduce to instruction as well as to edification. More and more attracted by the study of church history thus required, Baronius began diligently to collect and compare materials for its prosecution, and worked for 30 years amidst the vast mass of unpublished material which the Vatican archives contained, none of which were available to those who put together the evangelical history, the Magdeburg Centuries. And he worked for 30 years. I'll tell you something that would make me really put in an argument. If you want to know, you know, once in a while people call and they want to know more about Gene Scott. You want to know what would make me almost beg God to free me from pastoring, sitting here, or doing anything else?
This is the end of side one. For more of the teaching, please turn the tape over for side two. Thank you.